Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk about white Christian nationalism
with our guest, Robert P. Jones, president of PRRI and author of a powerful new book,
The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Trucks with relief supplies continued to enter Gaza through the Rafah crossing from Egypt on Friday after the entry into force of a four-day pause in fighting, UN humanitarians said, amid reports of the first release of hostages held by Hamas since its terror attacks in Israel on the 7th of October. Here's UN Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Office OCHA spokesperson Jens Lerke addressing reporters in Geneva.
We hope the agreement between Israel and Hamas, now in force, will bring respite to the people of Gaza and Israel and some relief to the hostages and detainees who will be released and to their families.
Mr. Lerke reiterated calls for access to all parts of the war-shattered enclave, including the north where the damage and humanitarian needs are the greatest, as the death toll in the strip inched towards 15,000 and many displaced people were sleeping in the streets. Thousands of Gazans are estimated to be trapped under the ruins of their houses, and Mr. Lerke insisted on the need to get more fuel into the enclave to operate machinery to get people out of the rubble. He also expressed hope that the pause in fighting will be extended into an actual humanitarian ceasefire in the long run. Antarctica has been called the sleeping giant, but it is now being awoken by climate chaos. That's the message from UN Chief Antonio Guterres, who has been visiting the icy landmass this week and highlighting the disastrous effects of global warming. Fossil fuel pollution is heating our planet, unleashing climate anarchy in Antarctica, he said, adding that the Southern Ocean has taken the majority of the heat from the rise in global temperatures. UN Weather Agency WMO warned in October that Antarctic sea ice had been at record low levels for months, with direct impacts on ecosystems near and far. Mr. Guterres's visit came just days before the start next week of the COP28 climate conference in Dubai. He urged leaders who will participate to act now to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, protect people from climate chaos, and end the fossil fuel age. In Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, those displaced by the fighting between government forces and non-state armed groups live under the constant threat of violence and sexual assault as they try to survive, UN humanitarians said on Friday. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said that its staff on the ground heard from people who fled to Sake, a town 35 kilometers west of Goma, about the harrowing choices they have had to make, with men risking death to feed starving children and women risking rape to collect firewood. Armed clashes have forcibly displaced more than 450,000 people in the last 6 weeks in North Kivu province, many living in overcrowded sites with limited access to food and clean water. UNHCR said that its monitoring in eastern DRC showed over 3,000 reported human rights violations in October, nearly double the figure from the previous month, which include rape and arbitrary killings, kidnappings, and extortion. Together with the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, the agency sounded the alarm over this pattern of abuse of civilians and stressed that the crisis is exacerbated by the limited humanitarian access to those in dire need, primarily due to the obstruction of major routes. Some 200,000 internally displaced people have been cut off from essential humanitarian aid, and an additional 100,000 could become stranded in the coming days, the UN agency said. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-host Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and that, of course, was Over the River and Through the Woods, a song often sung on Thanksgiving as people travel to meet with family and friends. And by the way, there is a free thought connection. The lyricist of that song was Lydia Maria Child, the early 19th century freethinking author, poet, abolitionist, and activist for Native American and women's rights. And that was played by my co-host Dan Barker, and Dan is not here today because he's at Oxford University with our friend, the sociologist Phil Zuckerman, and they are doing a team debate for the Oxford Student Union against a Catholic cardinal and a Hindu author on the question, is God a delusion? And by the way, his special guest at the Oxford banquet and debate, appropriately, will be Richard Dawkins, who of course wrote The God Delusion. Dan and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and this is the November 23rd, 2023 episode of Free Thought Radio. Tori Niels with Audio for the Arts is our kind engineer in the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall, the National Office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. Regular listeners to the show know that Free Thought Radio is a weekly production. It's put on by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and FFRF itself has two purposes: to keep religion out of government, that's a big job, and social policy, and to educate the public about the views of us non-believers. And we have over 40,000 members today in North America. Over almost a third of the U.S. population today is religiously unaffiliated. Those are called the nones. And if you are a N-O-N-E, not an N-U-N, you might be curious about what FFRF stands for and our views, and we'd be glad to send you information if you go to the Ask for Info link at our website, FFRF.org. We need to organize and flex our collective muscle as we are facing a huge threat from Christian nationalism today in the United States, and it's growing scarier by the week. Later on today's show, we're going to talk about one of those threats. We're going to hear Mary Ziegler, the foremost legal expert on abortion rights. The law professor at the University of California, Davis, is not just a legal expert, but an advocate of abortion rights, and she received FFRF's Forward Award at our annual convention in October. She's been warning for a long time that a fetal personhood federal law, if not amendment to the Constitution, is the goal of the anti-abortion movement. You will not want to miss her caveat. And in a few minutes, FFRF Junior Counsel Sam Grover will join me to talk about FFRF's latest legal intervention, defending the rights of secular students at a public university to put on a drag show benefit, and a benefit that was canceled by a religious fanatic college president at a public university. Because tomorrow, November 24th, is the anniversary of the birth in 1868 of the composer Scott Joplin, and because Scott Joplin, the king of ragtime, was a non-believer, Dan's queued up bits of Maple Leaf Rag, Swipesy, Joplin's New Rag, and The Entertainer to play as outros on today's show. Isn't it tragic that Joplin died a pauper who would never know of the enduring success of his classic compositions? He did achieve a glorious true form of afterlife thanks to his genius. On a more personal note, Saturday, November 25th, is the anniversary of the birth of FFRF principal founder Anne Nicol Gaylor in 1926. My mother would have been 97. She often shared her birthday with Thanksgiving, and I know she sometimes found it hard to have her birthday overshadowed by a laborious day of cooking, although she was an excellent traditional cook. In later years, my father, Paul Gaylor, who also would have been 97, took over the cooking honors and also became a wonderful chef. While Anne loved pumpkin pie, any pie, she also loved cake and regarded cake as a special occasion, and usually it was her birthday cake that had to be sacrificed. Once I made her a pumpkin cake roll as a compromise. So I'll be thinking of her, as always, on this non-holy holiday. And speaking of Thanksgiving, you can see how some of our staff enjoy a secular Thanksgiving on this week's Ask an Atheist on Facebook Live, archived, as always, at FFRS YouTube channel, including the always suspenseful Tofurkey versus Poultry face-off. It was emceed by our witty employees, attorney Sam Grover and legal assistant Greta Martins. On this week's TV show, we also go back to American roots. On Freethought Matters, Dan spoke with Robert P. Jones, the founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute, you notice PRRI, about his very important new book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. The book focuses on the little-known doctrine of discovery. The 1619 Project it was vitally important, but Dan asked Robert Jones to explain why he thinks there's another date that is actually just as important, if not more.
I think the major contribution the 1619 Project made was in moving our focus from this narrow vision of the beginning of the country in 1776. If we narrow our vision to there, it really is a bunch of white guys in a room with their quill pens in Philadelphia, right? That's the beginning story of the country. And of course, that's far too narrow a lens to be a true story about the country. So the 1619 Project suggested this: we need a new origin story that has to include the kidnapping and enslavement of Africans brought forcibly to this country. And I'm arguing, yes, that's right, but there's another date, and that is 1493, that we really ought to have in our kind of timeline of beginning stories and origin stories, genesis stories of the country. What happens, of course, in 1493 is that is the year, not the year that Columbus first sailed the ocean blue. The next year, 1493, is the year he goes back. And he asked for more ships, more soldiers, more missionaries. But the thing that I think is so important that really sets the moral compass of what happens with Europeans here in this country is that he asked for a moral mandate from the church, from the head of the Christian church, who had been developing what has come to be called the doctrine of discovery, that essentially gave permission for Europeans to conquer, to occupy, to steal, and to kill indigenous people. And the functioning metric there was, are these people Christian? If the answer was no, then the church gave explicit permission, again, to kind of occupy the land, steal their goods, and if they resisted, to kill them, or in the words of the document, to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. So I think if we only go back to 1619, we've actually missed more than a century of European contact with indigenous people. So if we're going to have the whole story, we're going to have to keep widening the lens and paint on an even bigger canvas than that.
So very timely interview, and you can watch that episode of Freethought Matters right now on the Freethought Matters playlist at FFRF's YouTube channel. But if you live in one of the 13 major cities where Freethought Matters is currently broadcasting on local TV, you can watch that show every Sunday morning. Well, here in Madison, Sunday evenings. For stations and times, check ffrf.org/freethoughtmatters, or you can look for the show under the news link at ffrf.org. So let's turn to the news. As we pointed out last week, seemingly every day there are new revelations about the irreligious extremism of our new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. The New York Times this past weekend revealed some of these links, including an interview with Mike Johnson on World Prayer Network on October 4th, 2023. Note, that was about 3 weeks before he became Speaker of the House. He was interviewed by Evangelical Jim Garlow, and guess how they opened the show? What was that, you ask? That was the sounding of the shofar. And that sounding of the shofar, by the way, led up to the January 6th insurrection at the Jericho marches. This is from the Old Testament, where Joshua marched around Jericho 7 times with the priests blowing these trumpets to take down the walls of Jericho. And they want to take down the wall of separation between state and church now, as well as our government. Mike Johnson was the principal architect of plots to overthrow the results of the presidential election, by the way, and of course voted not to certify Biden as president along with 147 of his fellow Republicans in Congress. Most of them would qualify, like Johnson, as Christian nationalists. So as Dan and I were suffering through this interview over the weekend to grab some clips for you, we noticed that the program didn't sound like a prayer, it sounded like a political briefing. And here are some of Johnson's shocking statements in early October.
We all know that the terrible state that we're in, the faith in our institutions is as low as it's ever been in the history of our nation. The culture is so dark and depraved that it almost seems irredeemable at this point. The church attendance in America dropped below 50% for the first time in our history since they began to measure the data 60 years ago. And the number of people who do not believe in absolute truth is now above the majority for the first time. So 1 in 3 teen girls contemplated suicide last year. 1 in 4 high school students identified as something other than straight. We're losing the country.
So the number of people who do not believe in absolute truth is now above the majority for the first time. He's talking about people who don't go to church. Most people don't go to church. He's paying attention. Like I always say, why don't politicians pay attention to the changing demographics? Well, the Christian nationalists are paying attention to the changing demographics that a third of us are no longer affiliated with a religion, and they are running scared, and they are determined not to lose their power. Among the zealous statements Johnson made was this remark.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. The idea was that we knew that our rights came from God, and thus our allegiance and accountability was to him, and we walked away from that.
So that was saying that allegiance is with God, not with we, the people. And by the way, Mike Johnson teaches a course on biblical principles that the Constitution was founded on, and apparently he's never read the Constitution because it's godless and there are no biblical principles in it. And finally, for more welcoming news, on behalf of FFRF, this week we filed an amicus brief for our friends at the Secular Student Alliance asking an appeals court to lift a stay on drag shows at Texas A&M Branch campus. And you may recall that we named the two student plaintiffs in that case recipients of our two major student activist awards at our national convention where they spoke and were fittingly introduced by local drag performers. And the reason FFRF got involved is because the president of this public university canceled the drag show that the student groups were using as a benefit for the Trevor Project, which works to prevent suicides by LGBTQ youths, saying repeatedly that he was doing so because of religion, that every human being is created by God and natural law, and this has no shred of human dignity. He talked about Christ. And so joining me to talk briefly about the legalities of this case is the attorney of record in the amicus brief and our Thanksgiving MC, Sam Grover. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio, Sam.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be back on.
So tell us about this amicus brief.
Right. So we filed this brief on behalf of the Secular Student Alliance, who has an interest in having, you know, their student groups and students generally be able to meet and freely express their views on college campuses. And at West Texas A&M, the university president, Walter Wendler, is allowing his personal religious beliefs to interfere with students' free speech rights. So that's what our brief to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals was all about. Basically,
Go ahead.
Yeah. So basically this group, Spectrum WT, attempted to put on a fundraising event to support LGBTQIA+ rights. And in putting on that fundraiser, the event was going to be a drag show. And Wendler took issue with this, calling it distasteful and basically saying it conflicted with his personal Bible-based belief system. Therefore, he rejected the event, and Spectrum WT wasn't able to put on their fundraiser. They sued, rightfully so, and at the district court, this judge, who is a very conservative judge, who previously worked for Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian nationalist organization, rejected the idea that a drag show is inherently expressive, saying that it isn't necessarily an expressive thing that would be protected by the First Amendment, which is just patently ridiculous.
Yeah, I can't think of anything much more expressive.
Yeah, exactly. And so, he gives sort of a reason, a very bad one, for why it might not be so, claiming that, you know, some drag shows might be put on purely for entertainment and not with any expressive purpose. And we said that this argument is sort of akin to saying that someone wearing a black armband in protest of the Vietnam War isn't necessarily expressing anything, because some people wear armbands purely for fashion reasons, right? The idea here is this event, Spectrum WT's event, was absolutely meant to be a commentary on hostility towards LGBTQ plus people and the sort of the backlash that we see socially against the rise in prominence and public awareness of LGBTQ issues.
We have about just a minute left. The brief does go into the many hostile bills in the Texas legislature in particular, correct?
Yeah, there are a number of bills that are being considered in Texas right now to cut down on trans rights specifically and other LGBTQ persons' rights in the state. So that's something that we're monitoring closely, and hopefully we can curb some of those from going into effect as well.
So the lawsuit will continue at the district level. What this motion before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is to get a restraining order for now against the president?
Yeah, exactly. So the district court didn't issue a preliminary injunction that would have allowed Spectrum WT to put on their event in the future. They've got another one planned for March. The district court didn't see this as needing a preliminary injunction, but obviously it does. And so we hope the Fifth Circuit reverses that decision.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, for being the attorney of record, helping to write that excellent amicus brief, which is up on our website. You'll want to read all about it. And also congratulations on FFRF's series of victories in the last month at the court level.
Well, thank you. Nice to have some wins.
And when we come back, we are going to give thanks where it is due, not to a deity, but to people. And then we're going to hear Mary Ziegler, a legal expert on abortion, talk about the threat of legal personhood for fetuses.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Annie Lurie Gaylor. During Thanksgiving, we non-religious folk also have reason to be grateful, but our gratitude is offered to real people. Dan Barker, my co-host, isn't here today, but let's listen to his new song, Let's All Give Thanks, performed by the amazing Godless Gospel group at FFRF's convention last month. The soloist you're hearing is jazz singer Tahira Clayton.
Let's all give thanks. Let's all give thanks. Not too religious.
was given, that of your turkey. Yes.
Clayton and the Godless Gospel Group performing Let's All Give Thanks, written by Dan Barker, arranged by Andre Forbes. And let's indeed give thanks not to religion, not to a God, but to real people who've made the world a better place for me and you. And so I give thanks also to the Godless Gospel Choir, Dan and Andre, because that is really a treat. After the break, legal abortion expert Professor Mary Ziegler will talk about the evolving legal status of abortion rights in the United States and what's at stake.
Hi, I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective association of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate, just like our founding fathers intended. Please support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Free Thought Radio, and this is the interview portion of Free Thought Radio. Mary Ziegler, a noted abortion rights legal expert and advocate and Harvard Law School grad, received the Freedom From Religion Foundation's Forward Award at our annual convention in October, which is reserved for individuals moving society forward. She's a 2023 Guggenheim Fellow, and she's written 6 books on abortion history and rights, including Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment, and Roe, The History of a National Obsession. And you can get Dollars for Life at fffref.org/shop, by the way. Mary Ziegler is a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Let's listen to an excerpt of her acceptance speech, which tells the history of the religiously motivated anti-abortion movement up to the present day and the threats involved in their goal to declare fetal personhood.
When Justice Alito told us what it meant that Roe v. Wade had been overturned, he told us that the destruction of abortion rights was necessary to protect American democracy. The permissibility of abortion and the limitations upon it, he wrote, are to be resolved like the most important questions in our democracy by citizens trying to persuade one another and then voting. What I'm going to tell you today is that the history of Roe's death and the story of what comes next is very much a story about American democracy, but not the one that Justice Alito might want us to believe. It begins with efforts to bypass changes created in democratic politics to recognize fetal personhood and to revolutionize what constitutional equality means, not just for women and other people who can get pregnant, but for people of color, people born outside of the United States, and others who the Supreme Court has recognized as protected classes. It's a history of how efforts have unfolded, not just to change which constitutional rights we have, but to change the ground rules of our elections, from the flow of money into politics to the ability of people to vote. And so generally, of course, the demise of Roe forces us to consider how we might achieve the demise of Dobbs, or what reproductive justice means, or what progressives have done wrong in the past that could be remedied in the future. But it's also a reminder that the fall of Roe should matter to you, even if you are past reproductive age or were never particularly interested in the abortion issue in the first place, because it's a story about not just the struggles over control of one's body, but control of the ballot box and the definition of equality. The struggles over fetal personhood were not, as Justice Alito might have us believe, starting in the 19th century when there was an early anti-abortion movement led by doctors in the American Medical Association. These doctors certainly argued that a fetus was a separate biological person with moral standing, but they had no claims that they made about the Constitution or about rights. This, in some ways, was not surprising at the time. The American Medical Association of the era was deeply racist, and making claims about constitutional rights or personhood almost inevitably in the era meant drawing an analogy to questions of race. It was in this era that prominent abolitionists, from Frederick Douglass to Abraham Lincoln, argued that the Supreme Court got it wrong in Dred Scott versus Sanford when it held that a man of African descent could not be a citizen and therefore had no standing in court. They argued that rights attached all persons in the United States, regardless of race. Later generations of anti-abortion activists, as you know, often compare a fetus to a person of color and say both are denied personhood or humanity. But the American Medical Association had no interest in making this argument, either before or after the text of the Constitution changed, because the analogy presupposed that people of color actually were persons with rights, and that was not something that people in the American Medical Association were prepared to acknowledge. So Storer, who's really the father of early anti-abortion efforts, instead argued about biology and demography, that Catholic women were having too many children and Protestant women were having too few, and that abortion quite simply denied the nature of women and their obligations to their husbands. Were women intended as a mere plaything, Storer wrote, there would have been no need for her to have a uterus or ovaries. So abortion opponents in the 19th century didn't say anything about the Constitution, and the people who wrote the Constitution didn't say anything about abortion, which means that the original public meaning arguments for personhood are not that great. But fetal personhood as a movement became deeply important in the 1960s anyway. It began when efforts started to reform criminal abortion laws, the ones that Horatio Storer gave us in the 19th century. At the time, a predominantly Catholic movement initially wanted to argue simply that legal abortion was unnecessary. Catholic physicians argued that pregnancy was no longer dangerous and people no longer died during pregnancy, or that victims of sexual assault couldn't get pregnant at all. To our great shock and surprise, these arguments were unsuccessful, and abortion reform continued apace. And so, failing to convince Americans that they did not want legal abortion, anti-abortion lawyers began to argue that they could not have it anyway because abortion reform itself was unconstitutional. They debated various arguments for stressing this point, at first comparing a fetus to a criminal defendant, denied counsel, or a fair hearing. But the problem with this argument was that the remedy for this kind of procedural failure was more process, like a hearing or an attorney. And abortion opponents didn't want a woman to be able to have an abortion after a hearing. They didn't want anyone to have an abortion at all. There were arguments that there might be an implied right to life in the Constitution, just as there are other rights not spelled out in the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. But this was problematic for abortion opponents who were against contraception because the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on implied rights had recognized a right to use birth control as well. The need for a new constitutional argument became even more urgent in a world where abortion was a crime and deep racial and class disparities emerged. At the time, abortion had become relatively safe for people who had private insurance and were able to use private hospitals, with mortality rates plummeting. But many patients of color were not able to access private hospitals, and their mortality and morbidity actually increased in the 1950s and 60s. And so it became possible for supporters of the separation of church and state to argue that criminal abortion laws were a deep equality problem. Abortion opponents began arguing that, in fact, abortion was the equality problem, and that the true victim of discrimination was the fetus or unborn child. To do so, they had to propose a complete reworking of equality law in the United States. Often when we ask if someone is a victim of discrimination in the United States, we ask if they belong to a community that's been historically discriminated against. Anti-abortion lawyers conceded that that wasn't true of fetuses. After all, there had been laws since the 19th century criminalizing virtually all abortions. They argued, in fact, that a history of past discrimination was quite simply irrelevant for all Americans, and what mattered instead was physical vulnerability. From the very beginning, then, this was an argument that would have had ramifications for many Americans. If accepted, it would have changed the way courts approached discrimination on the basis of race, sex, national origin, and much more. It was an argument that captured the imagination of lay Americans who flocked to single-issue anti-abortion organizations across the United States in the 1970s. These groups continued to talk about equality under the law, even as they maintained that most of those who had abortions were, quote, married women who had goofed their birth control and were lying to themselves about what they were doing. Over time, they began to frame equality arguments in a way that tracked how conservative white Americans were thinking about equality. As white Americans resisted the Supreme Court's desegregation decision in Brown versus Board of Education, they began to argue that the real problem with constitutional equality was classifying people, putting people in categories. So it really didn't matter if your community had been subordinated in the past or not. It simply mattered that you'd been put into a box. If that was true, they argued, it was unfair to put the fetus into a box and to classify the fetus based on residence in the womb rather than their individual merits, which of course were impossible to determine during a pregnancy. I think many of us believed that fetal personhood arguments disappeared for a time because we didn't hear about them, right? We heard about this effort to overturn Roe v. Wade. In truth, they really went underground. For a decade and more after Roe, the fight for a constitutional amendment led anti-abortion groups to forge a partnership with the Republican Party and sideline members of the movement who didn't agree with the Republican Party's prerogatives. But a constitutional amendment of any kind really was not forthcoming. So the movement found another goal in the improbable place of Akron, Ohio, where the Supreme Court upheld an ordinance, or actually struck down an ordinance, but Ronald Reagan's only Supreme Court justice at the time, Sandra Day O'Connor, was deeply critical of Roe. So the alternative and the justification for aligning with the Republican Party became getting rid of Roe. But that didn't mean personhood arguments went underground or that they were any less religious. Instead of openly defending the idea of personhood under the Constitution, anti-abortion groups just sought to write it into other areas of the law. They did so in a way that shored up their relationship with a Republican Party at the time deeply committed to incarcerating people. Ronald Reagan in the era tapped into support for various victims' rights movements, but he redefined victimhood, suggesting that the way to vindicate the rights of victims was not to support them directly, but to harshly punish those who wronged them. Anti-abortion groups picked up on this idea, arguing that the fetus was a victim of crime who had been denied recourse. They fought for fetal homicide laws and for laws authorizing the criminal punishment of pregnant drug users for child abuse or child neglect. Research of the era found that black women were 10 times more likely to be reported to the authorities for drug use during pregnancy, and even when they were acquitted, which was often the case, denied custody of their children or forced to defend their parental rights in court and sometimes had seeing them terminated. All of this, anti-abortion groups argued, was a stepping stone to recognizing the personhood of the fetus as a matter of faith and a matter of constitutional law.
After the break, we'll hear more of Professor Mary Ziegler's speech on the history of abortion rights and the zealous anti-abortion movement's goal to declare that fetuses have all the legal rights of people. I'm Annie Laura Gaylor. We'll be back in a minute with the end of Free Thought Radio.
I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is the final segment of Free Thought Radio. And we're listening to a really smart person give a really smart speech, law professor Mary Ziegler, who is the legal expert on abortion rights and the religious war, really, against abortion rights as well. Author of Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. She received FFRF's Forward Award at our 2023 National Convention, and let's continue listening to that acceptance speech.
At the same time, anti-abortion lawyers began to promote a vision of constitutional interpretation that would make it much easier to weave religious claims back into the law. And in doing so, they borrowed from conservative Christian litigators who were fighting against the legalization of same-sex intimacy. At the time, on occasion, when the Supreme Court was figuring out whether someone had a right to do something that wasn't spelled out in the text or Constitution, they would look to what they called history and tradition. But the justices recognized that history and tradition changed, that our traditions in 2023 are not the traditions we held in 1883 or 1903. Conservative Christian attorneys weren't happy with this and wanted to argue that traditions couldn't change because they were, in fact, rooted in Christianity, which itself didn't change. They didn't make this argument directly, believing correctly that at the time it would have gone down in flames, but they argued that history and tradition still should be understood as fixed in time at the moment the Constitution was written. And so it was, they argued in the 80s, that, quote, the right to homosexual sodomy, unquote, could not be protected because historically and traditionally, quote, Western Christian society has considered the practice of sodomy as within the proper scope of government regulation. Anti-abortion groups recognized this could be a way for them to get their own constitutional goals achieved. They could argue that historically and traditionally, our nation had not recognized a right to abortion and had maybe even permitted or even required the punishment of people who wronged the fetus. So this path to fetal rights seemed smooth, and many expected that the way to get rid of Roe was simply to get Republicans elected who would vote to nominate and confirm Supreme Court justices. But that turned out not to be true. In 1992, as many of you remember, a Supreme Court chock full of Republicans voted to preserve what it called the essential holding of Roe, namely that there was a right to choose abortion before viability. Casey sent the anti-abortion movement back to the drawing board. And what the movement concluded, in effect, was that it needed more power within the Republican Party to ensure that the right kind of justices were picked. And the path to that kind of power, of course, involved money and voting. It was then that anti-abortion groups looked to the example of Pat Buchanan, who some of you may remember. Pat Buchanan was the Donald Trump of the era. To a certain audience, he was good TV. He also went over well with deeply conservative Republican primary voters until the then Republican establishment realized that Buchanan was a toxic figure who may well lose a general election. And they literally buried Buchanan in a tidal wave of money. Bob Dole's campaign, his vice chair of his campaign, was one of the Koch brothers, and he had donors, everybody from Philip Morris to Nabisco Tookies to Gallo Winery. So anti-abortion groups realized they needed to compete with that tide of money to get someone like Pat Buchanan over the hump. So they joined a fight against campaign finance. They partnered with the Federalist Society and the conservative legal movement. And they found a way to argue that they weren't anti-woman because, in fact, women were like victims of big tobacco. They were not innocent because it was okay to have an abortion or it was wrong to punish someone who had knowingly had an abortion. They were victims because they didn't know what abortion was, just as tobacco users had been deceived by a massive, deceitful industry. You see this analogy quite clearly with anti-abortion opponents who still refer to abortion as, quote, big abortion, just as we see the analogy to big tobacco. This argument was powerful because it suggested that women who did know what they were doing could, in fact, be punished for abortion. It was also compelling to a changing anti-abortion movement in its composition. Anti-abortion groups, for the most part, had been single issue, in part because they feared being labeled religious, right? The early anti-abortion movement was overwhelmingly Catholic, and abortion rights supporters often criticized that movement by saying it was a threat to the separation of church and state, a way for one group of people to impose their theology on everybody else. So anti-abortion groups tried really hard to make it seem as if that wasn't the case. They refused to take on issues like the death penalty or contraception that could make their cause look more religious. But by the 2000s, that had begun to change, and again, because of money. The more money flowed in and out of conservative religious organizations, the more conservative Protestant groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom, one of the groups that litigated Dobbs, became prominent. The Alliance Defending Freedom began raising money like gangbusters. It now has a well over $125 million annual budget. And the Alliance Defending Freedom was perfectly comfortable framing its cause as a Christian one and framing abortion as one of several issues related to religious liberty, the establishment of religion, same-sex marriage, and much more. As Alliance Defending Freedom leaders explained, quote, "The Constitution was designed to reflect the Christian worldview of America's founders, who believed that our nation, quote, springs from the recognition of a creator God." So money enabled people who had been on the margins to come to the forefront of the anti-abortion movement and to make the possibility of a Pat Buchanan success thinkable. It was this idea that brought anti-abortion groups to the forefront of the litigation of Citizens United versus Federal Election Committee, which was started as many crucial campaign finance cases in the Supreme Court were by the anti-abortion attorney James Bopp. Citizens United was crucial for the anti-abortion movement in part because many anti-abortion groups are corporations and Citizens United allows corporations to have unlimited independent expenditures. It also changed the balance of power in the GOP. In the past, when someone like Pat Buchanan rose to the forefront, most money ran through political parties, and political parties who saw a candidate like Donald Trump or Pat Buchanan would use money to shunt them off to the side, prioritizing electability and making the trains run on time. But after Citizens United, a great deal of money is what we now think of as outside spending, right? Super PACs and nonprofits that don't care as much what the mainstream GOP, if such a thing even exists anymore, would think. So it was in part that Donald Trump was able to survive a primary challenge, not because he outraised or outspent his opponents, but because he had a cushion of outside spending to help him fend off challenges from what was remaining of the political establishment. Anti-abortion groups understood it was important to limit who could vote too. True the Vote, which was formed in 2009, had as its lawyer a prominent anti-abortion attorney, James Bopp, who filed lawsuits in New Mexico and Virginia to stop those states from permitting early in mail-in balloting. In November 2020, after the election was over, Bopp filed four lawsuits challenging polling practices in 18 counties across four crucial states, including Wisconsin, seeking to overturn the election. He eventually grew disturbed by what he thought would be a failed strategy and bowed out of the case. And he told me later that his deep regret was not that he had tried to overturn the election, but that Rudy Giuliani was a terrible attorney. And he spent hours in his mind playing out how a better lawyer or a better strategy would have meant that Donald Trump could stay in the White House even longer. The end of the 2020 election hasn't changed the movement's interest in reducing voting rights. Prominent anti-abortion groups like the Susan B. Anthony List and the Thomas More Society have their own initiatives to limit voting. And yet it was, in the lead up to Dobbs, that anti-abortion lawyers insisted that it was Roe that was the threat to democracy, that Roe had taken away the abortion issue from the people and stopped them from having a say. This was the story Brett Kavanaugh told us. He promised a brighter tomorrow after Roe, the idea that we would all just sort this out among ourselves like friends in the states, and that sooner or later, the bitterness surrounding the abortion issue would fade into the rearview. That was never going to happen to begin with, in part because the Dobbs decision was deeply counter-majoritarian, ran against what Americans had indicated they wanted for poll after poll for 50 years. It's also wrong in part because it's not what anti-abortion groups wanted either. They want fetal personhood, which is much more than the Supreme Court gave them in Dobbs. That's why we've seen a dynamic where in the aftermath of Dobbs, Americans who support abortion have done remarkably well at the polls, winning every single ballot initiative on abortion rights to come before them since the Dobbs decision. From the 1960s onward, the fight over abortion has been a struggle over the separation of church and state, and it's been a struggle over what we mean about equality under the law and who gets it. And it's become, I think, a fight over the kind of democracy we want to have, or indeed if we will have one at all anymore.
That was Professor Mary Ziegler, and you can watch that entire speech by visiting FFRF's Convention 2023 page at ffrf.org/convention. Look for, I think it's just past conventions if you don't see it. And it's a wonderful speech. FFRF's newspaper, Free Thought Today, will be reprinting Mary Ziegler's speech and all convention speeches soon. And you can also purchase her book, a very telling book, Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment, at our shop at FFRF.org. And so I want to wish everybody a very secular and non-holy Thanksgiving. I hope you have a good meal and a good break. And that's our show for today. I also want to thank our engineer, Tori, and who's doing such a good job. And thank you for listening. And also, we want to thank listeners or greet listeners in Philadelphia, WOOMLP, heard in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Bryn Mawr, WZMLLP, in Madison, Wisconsin, Wide FM, and WMUU, Community Radio, WADR, in Janesville, Wisconsin, KEOS, in College Station, Texas, in San Marcos, Texas, KZSM, Columbia, Missouri, KOPN, Eugene, Oregon, KEPW-FM, and my favorite name, Black Sheep Radio, WOOL, in Bellows Falls, Vermont, /New Hampshire, Kingston, Rhode Island, WRIU, and WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And if you're listening to the podcast, give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and let your friends and family learn more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio. You can listen to the show on our website, of course. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday